My castaway this week is a playwright. He has an impeccable pedigree. He wrote his first play at school and saw it performed by the University Dramatic Society while he was at Oxford. He got a first-class degree, went straight to the Royal Court, and over the next 7 years wrote plays, The Philanthropist among them, which are highly regarded in modern English theatre. But that's only half the story. Theatre alone has not been able to contain the talents of a man who's since written many successful screenplays, including Dangerous Liaisons, for which he won an Oscar, translated the works of Ibsen and Chekhov, written the book for Sunset Boulevard, and most recently turned to directing films with Carrington, which he also wrote. "What I like to do," says the man who seems to have done it all, "are things I haven't done before." He is Christopher Hampton. What you sound like, though, Christopher, is a man who can't say no. Is that more the case?
No, I don't think so. I have been known to say no from time to time, but I do probably err on the side of doing too much.
Is that because you're worried that the offers will stop coming? Is it the sort of freelance mentality?
Not really, because in my 20s, when I was having a more ordered existence and living in London and working at the Royal Court and turning in a play every couple of years, my agent, Margaret Ramsay, who was a legendary figure and a very important person in my life, used to ring me up once a week and say, "You must do more. You must do more. You can't just rest on your laurels. You can't just turn in these plays every couple of years. You must think what else you want to do." And slowly, this water torture got through to me.
But it was also the case, wasn't it, that you and your good friend David Hare, also a playwright, of course, believed that it was impossible to survive as a playwright beyond the age of 30. So
we used to sit and there we were in our early 20s at the Royal Court and say, "We've got 10 years. You know, we used to look at other people's careers. The theatre burns you up," we used to say. "We've got 10 years, and how are we going to get through the rest of our lives?" And it's true to say that, having had my first play on when I was 20, at the age of 30 I had a play called Treats, which was very poorly received by the critics. And at that moment I thought, well, I've had my 10 years and I'd better diversify.
But you're obviously very dedicated to your work. You sit at a large table, I read, and write most days. But 70% of that work, someone observed, never sees the light of day. It sort of moulders on the shelves.
It is much as that. I think I've written maybe 30 screenplays, of which 10 have been filmed. So looked at from one side, that's a very good average, one in three. On the other hand, there are these 20 scripts.
One of which was Carrington, of course.
One of which was Carrington.
You wrote, what, 17 years ago?
I wrote it in 1977, yes. I had a very good year writing it. I took a whole year off and wrote the script and was very proud of it. And then it took me 17 years to
How many more potential award winners are mouldering away on the shelves?
Well, I don't know. I don't really want to spend the rest of my life going through my back numbers, but there are one or two that I would quite like to resurrect. The good thing about scripts is that they continue to exist, and if anyone wants to do them at one time or another, then there they are.
Right, well, here we offer you the opportunity to stop and to sit back and reflect and look across at everything from the sort of singular safety of a desert island. Tell me about your music. What's the first record you've chosen?
The first piece I've chosen is a concerto by Vivaldi for four violins. George Fenton, who wrote and arranged the music for Dangerous Liaison, chose Bach's reworking of this to sprinkle through the film, and it's a piece I've always loved.
Part of Vivaldi's Concerto No. 10 in B minor for four violins, played by the Academy of Ancient Music, directed by Christopher Hogwood, and used, as you say, in your film Dangerous Liaisons. That began as a piece for the theatre, which you wrote about 10 years ago. And it was based on this not particularly well-known, I think one can say, 18th-century novel. What was your fascination with that novel and that story in the first place?
I'd come across the book, Les Liaisons Dangereuses, at Oxford. It was one of my set books for the period that I was studying, which was from the late 18th century to the 20th century. And it was one of those books that seemed to me to reveal various bleak truths, and was beautifully constructed. It was a book that I came back to again and again.
But it was in epistolary form,
wasn't it? Yes, it was. And in fact, the two central characters, the Marquise de Merteuil and the Vicomte de Valmont, never meet because they just write to each other. And so when I proposed it as a play, which I think I did to the National Theatre in the mid-70s, there was a lot of head-scratching, and people said, well, you know, I don't know whether this is dramatisable, and eventually, I was offered an open commission by the Royal Shakespeare Company in the mid-80s, and I chose to do this. And
what does an open commission mean?
It means I can write what I like, yes. And so I wrote this, and they were appalled, actually, when I told them what I'd done.
Why appalled?
Well, it turned out that they had already done a dramatisation of Les Liaisons Dangereuses in the mid-60s, which had not been one of their great successes. And therefore, the prospect of doing another one was not something that
you
they...
can understand why. I mean,
yes, of course.
I mean, 400 pages and practically 200 letters. How on earth are you going to turn this into a piece,
yes,
for the theatre that's going to hold the audience?
Yes, it was one of those extraordinary events in my life, really, because everything about it was a surprise. Although in the summer of 85, when we rehearsed it in Stratford with Alan Rickman and Lindsay Duncan and Juliet Stevenson and Fiona Shaw and a wonderful cast, we began to realise, rehearsing in our tin hut by the other place, theatre in Stratford, that something really exceptional was emerging. And the fact that it had the success that it had, I think, changed a lot of our lives.
And then 3 years later it was made into the film, starring, of course, Glenn Close and John Malkovich. What I'd really like to know about is how different the two scripts are, the screenplay and the piece for the theatre.
I think the screenplay is closer to the novel, because I think the form of a film is somehow closer to a novel. A stage play is a very artificial thing, and it has its iron laws, which you have to conform to somehow. A film is more fluid, like a novel. Actually, winds up like a novel too. Now these days, you can put it on the shelf at the end of the process.
But you can also you can juxtapose. You can have a change of scene much more quickly, can't you?
That's right. And for example, the ending of the film is much closer to the ending of the novel. The disgrace of the Marquise is very difficult to organise as on the stage. And in the stage, I sort of implied that she got away with it, that it was you know, her life was ruined, but that she'd got away with it. Whereas in the book, mostly to conform to, you know, moral ideas of the time, unleashed a series of terrible punishments on her.
Record number two.
It's from Mozart's clarinet concerto, which he wrote for an instrument much deeper in range, I discovered a few years ago, than the conventional clarinet. So this is a recording which uses an instrument called the basset clarinet.
Part of the second movement of Mozart's clarinet concerto, played by Anthony Pei with the Academy of Ancient Music, directed by Christopher Hogwood. Your play, White Chameleon, Christopher Hampton, produced at the National about 4 years ago, was pretty autobiographical, wasn't it? About
I think
a young
you could
boy.
Say it was entirely autobiographical. Having never before written autobiographically, I went the whole hog, you might say.
So it's a young boy in the 50s being brought up in Egypt, Suez.
Yes.
Being really finding himself at the centre of a conflict.
The happiest time of my childhood was this 5 years that I spent in Egypt. My father was a radio engineer, worked for Cable and Wireless. It was a bit like being in the army. You were posted around the world, you know, wherever they wanted you to go. But his favourite posting was Alexandria, where he'd first gone in the 30s. So we wound up there again in the early 50s. It was a sort of idyllic place to...
Why idyllic?
Well, it was very cosmopolitan. Boys I was at school with could mostly speak 5 or 6 languages. My parents were very fond of sport, so, you know, one was always swimming or yachting or going to the sporting club, doing, you know, one thing or another. And it was just a very nice way to grow up.
But Chris, boy in the play, was beaten up by his school friends, wasn't he?
Underneath all this, of course, there were political ructions of one sort or another leading towards the Suez Crisis. And the first crisis that happened was when King Farouk was expelled in 52 and we were sent back to England, evacuated. So that when the real crisis came in 56, we were rather blasé about it and in fact stayed right up to the last minute. My mother and I were evacuated on the last boat out. But naturally, being a British child... In Egypt, you got into trouble because the British were saber-rattling and so on. And then when you came back to school in England and repeated what my father had said to me, i.e. that the Suez invasion was completely unjustifiable and there was no reason for it at all, you got into trouble in England.
Well, you got beaten up here too.
Not exactly, no, but the headmaster, who was a very kindly man at the prep school that I'd sent to, brought me in to his office and said, you mustn't go around saying these sorts of things. You know, people are out there fighting and dying for their country, and you mustn't go around repeating these things that you may have heard somewhere or other. So all this was a very, was a sort of what you might call a political education.
So you were a sort of white chameleon and stuck in the middle, a sort of outsider. Did that mean that you wanted to write? Did that make you write? Is there any link there at all?
I don't really think so, because I'd already started to write at the age of 8 or 9 in Egypt. The school I was in, which was called the British Boys' School, had a drama department. And one of the things we did, we were asked to write plays, even at the age of 8 or 9, for our class to perform. And that's how I started.
What sort of thing did you write then?
I made adaptations from the works of Edgar Allan Poe, my favourite writer at the time. Concentrating on the blood and guts and leaving out all the philosophical, boring bits.
But did everybody know that Christopher wanted to be a writer, was that...?
Yes, actually my parents were very encouraging about it. Although it was not what you would call a literary household, there weren't many books in the house. Although my father was very fond of the cinema, he might have been expected to say, well, you'll never make a living at that. But instead he said, well, yes, you should start right away. He'd say things like, you know, Conan Doyle started writing when he was 14. I have no idea whether this is true or not, but it sounded convincing to me. So I felt, although this was a strange ambition, I didn't feel that it was one that was frowned upon.
Record number 3.
Well, my father was very fond of Buddy Holly, strangely enough, and he used to play his records a lot. And one of his songs that I'm particularly fond of, both because I like the tune and secondly because I think the sentiment in the title is unarguable. And that's a song called Love is Strange.
Love, love is strange. Lot of people take it for a game. Once you get it, you're in an awful fix. After you've had it, you never want it.
Buddy Holly and Love is Strange. So you went to public school back here in England, and then you wrote your first play while you were waiting to go up to Oxford, not least because you had a lot of time on your hands because you'd been expelled from the sixth form.
Yes, it's quite an extreme way of putting it. What had happened was that... I passed my exam into Oxford and was looking forward to... my father was by this time in Zanzibar. I was looking forward to having 2 terms at Lancing, just messing about, putting on plays and enjoying myself. And my housemaster, who somehow rumbled this, summoned me and said, we think it would be better for you, and indeed for the school, if you left.
Just like that?
So out I went into the world. And
that seemed rather unfair. Didn't you question it?
Well, I was startled, let's say, But in fact, looking back on it, it was a very good thing to happen, because that year, which was quite difficult, because my father had this knack of being in places where difficult things happened. There was a revolution in Zanzibar, so they became incommunicado. And what I did was, in a rather kind of obvious way, I suppose, I went to Paris and finished my novel and began to write this play, When Did You Last See My Mother?
What was the novel about, briefly?
It was a school novel, not very good, rejected by every publisher in London.
Still, that's mouldering on the shelf as well.
Well, I haven't seen it for a while, and in fact there was a fire at Peggy Ramsey's office a few years ago, and she rang me up and said, there's bad news and there's good news, she said. The bad news is that a lot of my archive has been destroyed by this fire, but the good news is I think your novel went up as well.
She was a pretty hard taskmaster, wasn't she?
She was a formidable lady, yes.
What's the rudest thing she ever said to you?
She didn't actually say it to me. I was standing in the doorway of her office. I'd come to visit her. And I heard her on the phone to a young writer saying, "Oh, you don't want to be like Hampton. You wrote one play which was a great success and then sat around for years. Get on with it, dear." And I said, "Peggy, I'm here." And she turned around and looked at me and said, "Well, it's true, isn't it?"
But the play, When Did You Last See Your Mother, it was eventually premiered at the Royal Court, now and having been performed by Ouds. But what was that luck, do you think, that it was performed at the Royal Court, or was it just...
It was Peggy Ramsey, actually. Really? I took advice at Oxford from a woman called Elizabeth Sweeting, who was at the Oxford Playhouse, and about getting an agent, because when I'd done the play in Oxford, I'd got lots of letters from agents. And she said, "Oh, the only agent worth thinking about is Peggy Ramsey." So I sent her the play. Two or three weeks later, the porter at New College arrived and knocked at my door and said, "There's someone on the phone." Now, this was unprecedented because, you know, you got messages if you were lucky. But for somebody to actually come and knock on your door proved that there was someone formidable on the other end. And it was Peggy Ramsey. And she said, "Come to London, dear." And she had got the Royal Court to agree to put the play on within about 6 weeks, I think.
And it was about two young boys waiting to go up to Oxford.
It was, yes. And it was a rather sort of Jacobean plot. One of them has an affair with the other one's mother, who then commits suicide. It was very, very lurid. And I don't think I've ever had such good reviews from that day to this.
Next piece of music.
I didn't really learn about music at all until I went to school and got a record player and began to listen to what other people were listening to. And one of my favourite records was the Amadeus playing Schubert's string quintet. And I discovered when I was researching Carrington that it was also a favourite of Lytton Strachey's and Dora Carrington's, so I included it in the film, used it, and used that recording.
Part of the second movement of Schubert's string quintet in C major, played by William Pleath and the Amadeus Quartet. So, Carrington, we said, you'd written some 17 years ago or so, but despite the success of Dangerous Liaisons, the backers didn't jump at it, did they?
No, they didn't jump at anything. This was a strange illusion that I had after I won the Oscar for Liaison, that somehow it would get easier.
But what were their reservations about Carrington?
I think that the subject matter, really, the sort of unconventional nature of their lives, and the tragic conclusion, which is always a thing that disturbs people who finance films. They don't like films with unhappy endings.
I suppose if you went along to an American backer and said, "I've got this story about a woman who falls in love with a homosexual and then kills herself," they would think it was too far-fetched.
No, that's what they said to me. That's why that was the phrase that was used to me in turning it down. I would say, well, it's not about that at all. It's about these people who had a sort of experiment in living. It's a very unusual love story.
But why were you so fascinated by it? Because it's a very small story, isn't it? It's a very small part of the Bloomsbury story as a whole, and indeed all those other characters, the Bells and the Wolves, are very shadowy in your piece. I mean, it's a big film, but it's a very small and tightly focused piece.
I was just interested in that relationship and the way two people could make a contract like that and live together very successfully for 17 years, I think it was, and pursue their own sex lives, actually, outside of the marriage, in inverted commas, and still remain entirely devoted to one another.
So what are you saying, that it's a sort of triumph of love over sex, is it?
It's, I suppose, an ultimate kind of acknowledgement that life is more complicated than it's cracked up to be. I always think oversimplification is one of the things that gets us into the trouble we get into.
And you ended up directing this film yourself. You'd never directed a film before. I mean, it was certainly a very brave thing to do. It might have seemed, at that stage, foolhardy too.
Desperation, I think it was. No, when Mike Newell decided he didn't want to do it, it was at quite a late stage. That's to say that Emma Thompson and Jonathan Pryce were already attached to the film. And we had specific dates.
But how did you know you could do it?
I didn't, actually. I had no idea that I could do it. I was in Los Angeles and went into a bookshop and bought a book called First Steps in Directing. Gave me a great deal of information. But I had very good people around me, and I was careful enough to hire people who were very experienced. And I was old enough not to be afraid to say, well, I don't know, what do you think, at various key moments, and not try and bluff it through.
Record number five.
Well, this is a favourite of mine. Janet Baker has a very beautiful voice, and I have an enormous number of her records. And I've chosen an aria from the St. Matthew Passion, Have Mercy, Erbarme Dich.
Aria Erbarme Dich, mein Gott, from Bach's St. Matthew Passion, sung by Janet Baker with the Munich Bach Orchestra, conducted by Carl Richter. Going back again to those early years of playwriting, Christopher, you were panned for your second play, Total Eclipse, which is now coming out as a film, but you had great success with your third play, The Philanthropist. But eventually, age 30, there was a kind of block, wasn't there? Was this your fears coming to pass? Perhaps you wished it upon yourself somehow, that you'd had it at 30.
It could be, but I think I was just ready to move on. I mean, I felt that I'd been at the Royal Court for 10 years. The Royal Court was a theatre for new writers and new plays, and I felt I wasn't a new writer anymore and probably shouldn't just go on having my plays done there. And in fact, the thing that I did immediately then was to write Carrington.
So it wasn't a real block then?
No, it wasn't a real block. There was a period of a few months when I couldn't work out what to do next.
I thought there was a point at which translation, which you've done a lot of, as I said in the beginning, was a kind of therapy somehow.
No, I'd always done that. I'd started that in 1970, I think I did my first. I did my first translation while I was still at Oxford in 67. It was a play by Isaac Babel, a Russian play called Maria. I find translation a sort of therapy. I always have one on the go. I have one, I'm doing one at the moment.
Well, you just enjoy the precision of it.
Yes, I suppose in the way some people do crossword puzzles or whatever, it's a great exercise for focusing the mind, actually, on the specific linguistic problems.
But people are less admiring of that kind of work. They're less admiring, I think, of translation and of adaptation than they are of original works. Do you think that's unfair?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can understand why. But, in fact, I think translators are shamefully under-acknowledged and underpaid and looked down on, really, in a way that's not justifiable. They have a tremendously important job to do.
What about adapters?
Well, that's, again, a skill that people, I suppose, tend to underrate. In the end, the business of putting in front of people for a couple of hours something that will engage them and interest them is so complicated that it doesn't really matter whose name is on the piece of work. It's getting a piece of work that will do that to an audience by whatever means you can.
But if we're talking about the way in which someone like you is regarded, I think it is true, isn't it, that you've been annoyed over the years when people have said, aren't you going to do another piece of original work, not another adaptation?
Yes, I suppose so, because I don't really see a distinction in the...
I suppose the implication is it's a less creative business because you're borrowing somebody else's plot, aren't you? And plotting is perhaps one of the...
It's an interesting thing, though, that people never say that about, let's say, film directors, which is also a secondary role, interpreting other people's work. I sort of don't spend a lot of time worrying about these categories, and I do have a list of original projects which are slowly thickening in notebooks here and there. So I don't feel any particular pressure in this respect, although it would certainly be nice if, for example, I can manage to establish myself as a film director to direct some original scripts. Why I haven't done that in the past is that the one time I did spend a year writing an original screenplay, it didn't get made, and that really is heartbreaking.
Record number 6.
Well, now, this is to do with Los Angeles. I spent such a lot of time in Los Angeles that I was eventually obliged to learn to drive, something I never got any good at all. But as I was scraping the wheels along the pavement in Los Angeles, I often used to have the radio on. One of the records of that particular year was something called Angel of the Morning by Juice Newton. It sort of summons up Los Angeles for me, which isn't entirely pleasurable, but it's played such a big part in my life that I feel I ought to be reminded of it.
Just
Juice Newton, an Angel of the Morning, and memories of a rented house with a white piano and a pool. And
that's right.
A year in Hollywood. Do you feel at home in Hollywood? I mean, you go to Oliver Stone's mansion or whatever, and I mean, what do you feel about these people when you get there? I can't imagine that you're totally at home in Hollywood.
No, but I don't. Well, I don't stay there. I mean, one of the good things about working there now is that you just go and you come back, so you don't have to live there. To work there, but you do have to work there if you work in films. And ever since I began with my first Hollywood film, which was an adaptation of Graham Greene's The Honorary Consul, which in America was called Beyond the Limit, because the man from Paramount said that out of the three-word title, The Honorary Consul, the American public would only understand one word. Ever since then, I've...
Did that depress you, or do you just shrug and smile?
What you have to, I suppose, learn to do in the end is to protect yourself. And the Honorary Consul was a project that I was very committed to. And in the end, it was renamed, it was re-edited, new music was put on it, and it was thumpingly denounced by Graham Greene in a lengthy article which revealed in the last paragraph that he hadn't seen it. So...
Did you give up at that point?
So you... You just have to take, as it were, the rough with the smooth. I don't know why it took me so long to realise that writing the kinds of films I'm interested in writing is the most difficult way in that you could possibly choose.
But obviously Hollywood fascinates you. In fact, you'd spotted the potential of Sunset Boulevard before Andrew Lloyd Webber, hadn't you?
I think it was sort of we were moving along parallel tracks. But I had been asked by the English National Opera if I would like to write an opera for them. Libretto. And I proposed to them Sunset Boulevard, and they were interested in this idea, and I wrote to Paramount. First of all, I wrote to Billy Wilder, who wrote back saying, you're a writer, how can you possibly suppose that I retain any rights to,
and
to
he
this
didn't.
Piece? And he didn't. So I wrote to Paramount, and they said no. They weren't interested in selling me the rights or negotiating an option or whatever. And a while later, I was having lunch with Andrew Lloyd Webber and told him about this, and he said that the person who was, in fact, negotiating with Paramount for the rights was himself. So I said, well, when you get round to doing it, let me know. And he did.
More music.
Well, I've chosen the closing aria from an opera by Philip Glass about Gandhi called Satyagraha, which I saw in San Francisco. And it's a very, very peaceful piece of music, which I think would calm the troubled brow when things got hard on the island, you know, after the typhoon or whatever.
End of Philip Glass's opera Satyagraha, sung by Douglas Perry with the New York City Opera Orchestra, conducted by Christopher Keane. So, Christopher Hampton, you're a writer, a playwright, a translator, an adapter, a lyricist, and a director. Which of your bodies of work are you proudest of? Is it possible to say?
Not really. There are plays of mine that I'm very pleased with, and films as well. So, it's hard to say. I mean, I suppose Carrington gave me my sense of achievement because it was germinated over such a long, long period. But Les Liaisons Dangereuses and the film of that were also things that I'm very proud of. So it's difficult to say. You plunge into these different things and you never quite know which ones are going to work and which ones aren't.
But you're happy to keep plunging?
Oh, yes, I think so.
What about Hampton as Robinson Crusoe? That's not a comfortable image, I suspect.
No, I think not very good at all. I don't think I would... I'm not very practical. I'm useless with my hands. I can't see straight. It's rather a gloomy prospect, I'm afraid.
What about mentally? Will you cope?
I think probably that wouldn't be so bad. And since one has plenty of time to do everything, eventually one might get the knack of, you know, weaving the roof of the hut or... whatever one's supposed to do.
So you're looking forward to it, really?
Well, I like the sea, I like the sun, so it would have its compensations.
Last record?
Well, the last record is from Mozart's Requiem. In fact, it's, I think, the last piece that Mozart ever wrote. It's the Lacrimosa.
Part of the Lacrimosa from Mozart's Requiem, performed by the Chorus and Orchestra of the Academy of Ancient Music, again directed by Christopher Hogwood. If you could only take one of those eight records.
Well, I think it would have to be the Bach, the Janet Baker, actually, because it's, for some reason, my favourite piece of music.
What about a book?
Well, at Oxford, my special subject was Proust, A la recherche du temps perdu, so I've never yet come across a novel that's as compendious and as astute about the human spirit and its difficulties, and it's sort of inexhaustible, I think, so I think that's the book I would take.
But you've already read it. I think you must be one of the few castaways to want to take it having already read it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Maybe I could amuse myself doing a translation of it.
And what about a luxury?
Well, I suppose a restaurant is out of the question.
Well, as long as you run it yourself. Can you cook?
No, that's why I asked for a restaurant. I suppose, actually, boringly, it would probably have to be an inexhaustible supply of black notebooks and Parker pens.
Christopher Hampton, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thanks very much.